is, once that crime has been committed, or they think it has, how do you go about bringing that man to trial in the ultimate penitentiary sentence? What's that?
Well, of course, you might reach it this way, after the grand jury is indicted. Require, if requested by the defendant, a preliminary hearing. That will give you a discovery. After the indictment. Then you've got a list of every witness that the state proposes to call. You then the state probably only called one person that can identify the individual as the fellow that came into the store. But they got five or six others on there. The defense, at least under my phone record, we just took that list and we subpoenaed the whole outfit and took their deposition and got their story before the case ever went.
Here, the state doesn't have to list every witness they proposed to call in. They have to list those witnesses who did actually appear before the grand jury.
Right.
They can hold back their case in the law if they can get a conviction case out of it.
Right. But usually, through that hearing, you'll find that you can discover who their prime witness is.
Yeah, I think that's a good suggestion.
And then you've got a right to go out and get that information from them.
And another thing about it is, we wouldn't have to tinker with the Constitution to do this.
I don't believe you would on that.
Because the grand jury, everyone would has that right, and they would have had it.
Yes.
And you could do the same thing after a, if there's good reason.
Can the arrested person be discharged after he's been indicted by a grand jury at a preliminary hearing? If he's charged with murder and brought up before a district judge on a preliminary hearing?
Normally, the preliminary hearing is when an information is filed and a preliminary hearing is requested, then there isn't any grand jury. But under the present practice, if the grand jury meets and returns an indictment, there's no preliminary hearing subsequently.
Yeah, but Bob's question is a little deeper than that. The purpose of a preliminary hearing now is to see whether there's evidence to
hold him. Yes, bind him over.
And if he's indicted, he's already had it.
That's right.
What I'm getting at, of course, is this idea of following the grand jury indictment with a preliminary hearing.
Yeah, what's the purpose of
it? It's a discovery.
It has no other purpose.
No, it can't. Now, under the other system, the information system, after the party has been bound over by the magistrate for trial, you can file in court, the circuit court, say here, you can file in the circuit court an application for a preliminary hearing, alleged in there. And of course, in those states, this is reported, that the evidence fails to show commission of a crime, or that there is probable cause to believe that this individual committed this particular crime. The circuit court would then examine that record, and if it found that the evidence was insufficient, could dismiss the information, or could hold his own preliminary hearing to see if the state could bring in additional testimony that would fill in the gap.
Judge, do you recall offhand some of the states that have such a procedure?
Well, I practice in Kansas, you know.
Kansas has it. Huh?
And
of course, if the object is to achieve discovery rights to defend, which now you can have at your preliminary hearing, if you can get a preliminary hearing before the DA takes the case to the grand jury, I think you have to keep your objectives separate. One is discovery rights of the defendant in criminal cases, and two, whether or not the grand jury system as such, of generally you charge crimes only by a grand jury indictment, whether or not that's a good system. If you if you decide the grand jury is, as Perry suggests, other than a few areas, an anachronism, that's one thing. Then, having decided, if you do, to go to the information system and allow the DA the same sort of real discretion that he now actually has as a practical matter, then it seems to me you ought to just forthrightly say, in criminal cases when a man's been informed against, he has A, B, and C discovery rights, and he can exercise them. It seems to me that if you place the discretion in the district attorney to inform then to come around behind the barn and say, however, we'll have a preliminary hearing, at which point the judge can throw it out, you're, in one sense of the word, you're having two trials for the defendant. And it seems to me the objective is man charged ought to have one fair trial, and at least some of us suggest the man charged ought to have fair discovery rights. Mm-hmm. And he can accomplish that by an information system plus a discovery statute, rather than going behind the barn and having an information system plus a what would be called a secondary hearing, in effect. I don't see the need.
Well, for an information system, we'd have to have a constitutional amendment.
We may have to have one for discovery statute. For depositions, yes. Yeah.
Now, not trying to avoid the constitutional prohibition, but maybe thinking way out in left field, I don't know. It might be that a statute permitting the accused to waive indictment by the grand jury, permit indictment by the district attorney, with the additional request that he be granted the right of preliminary hearing, and make it mandatory if he waits. If they grant him a preliminary hearing, might avoid the impact of the Constitution.
How about secret indictments where there is no accused yet? He wouldn't know how
he
would know.
You can't avoid that at all. But if they drag him in and his lawyer is sharp enough, they drag him in on information, he immediately files a waiver of indictment and request for a preliminary hearing. You might avoid it in some cases.
It would be some cases, because
few,
then the district attorney would simply wait and return secret indictment. Frank Knight would just be
here.
Yeah.
Now, if a person is arrested, he can waive grand jury now and go and proceed on information as district attorney. And once he's arrested, he's brought before the district court and request a preliminary hearing. And so he's got his preliminary hearing, and then if he wants to, can waive grand jury and proceed on district attorney's information. Oh, it's practical. Waiving grand jury is usually done only in cases where they're going to plead guilty. But
of course, if he isn't going to plead guilty, then the district attorney dismisses that complaint and takes the matter before the grand jury, doesn't he?
Well, that's probably going to have to follow the way the district attorney does. I don't know how the rest of them do it. For myself, I've had some cases where they waive grand jury and proceeded on information when I knew that they were going to plead not guilty and went ahead to trial. But
jury decided the defendant not guilty.
Yeah.
A lot of people think that, and they go in there, and of course we do have an instruction that the court says they don't always pay attention to the instructions, but I think that's an area that should be explored, of course.
Frank, let me ask you a question, if I may.
Okay.
As a district attorney, do you feel that it would be proper to provide an accused in every case either a preliminary hearing or something in the nature of a preliminary hearing so to avoid our present situation where there are secret indictments and there is a defense, he can't do anything?
Well, first, like I said about these secret indictments, most of the cases, I have to come out of secret indictment, are ones where I want to hear what that testimony is to see whether we have a case before the guy's indicted. And if he's not indicted, that's not even arresting to where it goes on his record as an arrest. Practical matter, I oppose discovery unless it's a two-way street. We have preliminary hearings, and if they're recorded, you get into trial, and there may not be any a great deal of variance between what the witness said at the preliminary hearing or what was said at the testimony of the trial, but then the defense attorney comes out pointing out all these little differences in the way he worded it, or sometimes there's something a great deal of variance in what he said. It might not be material to the case that's being tried, but there's some variance. And then with the state, with the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, then we face this argument, although usually when the defense attorney gets too dang picky-unish about it, it's not too successful with the jury. And I feel that if you're going to allow discovery on the part of the defendant, that there should be discovery for the state also, getting the proposed defense witnesses under oath and have them testify. If you're going to do the same for the for the defendant, I feel that if a criminal trial is a search for truth, let that both sides out in the open rather than letting the defendant come back, hear what the state's case is, and then the state not knowing until the testimony comes out at the trial, because especially if they've got anything that they don't want to find out about the way their opening statement until after the state's presented its case, so that it's just their statement and then defense. Testimony, and I would feel too that if we have discovery here in Oregon, that that along with the request, whatever it is, that the defendant also agree to submit himself to waive his Fifth Amendment rights.
Don't you think that the presumption of innocence is so inherent perhaps justifies this distinction?
Yes, I know you're going to say that we have the police and everybody else to do our investigation, of course, and have all these prior benefits. Sometimes I feel that this is an overrated.
Sheriff, just police. There is one method that hasn't been used too frequently in discovery, but when the district attorney chooses, as it did in the case that I once had, we scheduled a preliminary hearing and they had a grand jury prior to the scheduled date. That's perpetuation of testimony in a civil suit brought against one of the complaining witnesses, or in this sense, the complaining witness. Perpetuate her testimony in this instance because the defendant criminal case, thought he would be a claimant, bringing an action against her for libel and slander.
Well, on this preliminary hearing thing, I can't answer for all the district attorneys, but I take that position that once the person has requested a preliminary hearing, that he's going to have his preliminary hearing, even though it might mean that the grand jury happens to be scheduled to meet the day of the preliminary hearing, and I want to go ahead and, while I've got the grand jury in, present this case, that we'll have a preliminary hearing in the morning, and the case may be presented to the grand jury that afternoon. Or if the grand jury, the preliminary hearing isn't scheduled, say, until Friday, and I've got the grand jury coming in on Thursday, we'll either have a preliminary hearing moved ahead or not present it to the grand jury.
There's no requirement to do that.
No,
and what you always do it in a real tight and important case.
usually in that case, they got the preliminary hearing requested, and you're not going to, at least in a county like mine, you're not going to get the grand jury in.
Bob Chandler.
Senator, I wonder if there are a couple of basic things involved here. One, can you have a fair trial without some need of discovery for a defendant? Presuming that the presumption is that the man is innocent until he proves to be guilty, can he put up an adequate defense without knowing what's going to be said about him and by whom? The second one is that, as I understand the discovery, the record of it, in states that do have it now, that in many cases it eased the job of the district attorney rather than making it harder, because the defendant's lawyer begins to realize perhaps that the story that he's been told isn't quite the way it's going to be presented in court, and it results in, as I understand it, in an increase in the number of guilty pleas nice quiet arrangements with the district attorney, by which the charge is reduced in a guilty plea with a lower charge.
That's a reported experience in Vermont. I'd like to interrupt this for just a moment. Mr. George Platt, a professor of law at the University of Oregon, is here, and he has asked to sit as an observer with this committee. And I think this is an excellent opportunity. He's here today, an excellent opportunity. We might be able to utilize not only Mr. Platt, but others at the university. Mr. Platt, would you mind sitting up here?
Well,
if you would stand up. He's going to sit as an observer. He's not going to testify yet. I just want, since he's going to be involved in this, would you come right up here, Mr. Platt? This is Mr. George Platt, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Oregon. Are we through with Justice Perry? Mr. Dale Harlan.
Oh, we're never through with him.
Justice Perry, do you have any thoughts about the right of the state to appeal in criminal cases?
Yes, I do. This has happened in the past in this state. In a case which to me was one where the defendant was clearly guilty of the commission of the crime, the court did instruct the jury to bring in a verdict of not guilty. And there was no appeal. Now, I don't think that would happen in Jim's court. But I have known it to happen right in this state. But, however, I don't want you, in the condition of the court is in now, to open the door to the lie. especially to matters of whether or not certain acts constitute crimes. I prefer to leave those to the judgment of the circuit judges, and then come upon appeal in a regular way. Some states do have that provision.
Is there a feeling in the
part of some people around the state, some district attorneys and others, that, the present system with no appeal by the state is made to order for a judge who's, to say, less than aggressive, and he just agrees with the defense and his rulings more often than he might otherwise, so that, because there's no, you can't go wrong by agreeing with the defense.
Well, of course, I don't think that you'll run in the bank. I only know of two cases where this happened in the state, and I felt that it was probably a little roundabout way of paying off political debt in one case.
Representative Elder?
Well, isn't it also true that, I mean, the present system, you build up a body of law, precedents, and decisions, and so on, entirely in favor of the criminal's advocacy, not the state's. Because the state is never able to appeal their side of this matter, so they really don't get into the acting.
There's no case on that.
Right.
Since it doesn't get to the Supreme Court, it doesn't get that.
Well, but the criminal's side of the case is always, or nearly always, presented to the Supreme Court, and they rule in.
The threatened side of the case is challenging the state as to whether it's right or wrong, and it gets challenged all the time by the defense.
I don't think
the law is established, and it tends to be established in favor of the defense.
I'm surprised how many cases the defense loses in
that matter. But many times it's loosened up to the example.
I think a good example of this type of situation was after the Neely decision, that there were several instances, at least in my county, I know others, the rest of around the state, where we weren't able to get our confessions into court until some trial judge was capable by the court say, well, this doesn't come within Neely. The defendant appealed it, and then the Supreme Court said, well, of course this doesn't come within Neely. But we had many confessions thrown out and weren't able to get into court because our trial judge were interpreting, in effect, extending Neely on, and it wasn't until some trial judge would say, well, regardless of what Neely seems to say, I don't think this comes within it, and then the Supreme Court would say, well, we didn't. Finally, they think the Supreme Court backed up on you, at least some of the cases started going the other way.
That's great. You mentioned the possibility of limited appeal. If we consider the idea of appeal by the state, that you hope it would be limited, part of your hope, of course, is the court's workload situation, but I suspect that you have some basic point at which you think the appeal ought to be allowed regardless of the court's political situation where it ought to be stopped.
Yes, I have always felt that where there's a direct verdict based on the insufficiency of the evidence, that should be
a legal question, whether or not the fine state.
So old in the state of Barry, where are we? Oh, that's right. The Supreme Court indictment.
What's Representative Redden?
The writ of review, what extent that's used in Oregon? I've never tinkered with it, but isn't this a means by which the state can get a determination from the Supreme Court on an instruction or ruling on the law by the trial court?
No, I thought the writ of review applied only on civil. Of course, now, where I practiced before, I have to go back to 14 years I was back there. I was both a persecutor and defense counsel. The state could appeal a certain matter. Of course, the defendant is free from the state appeal claim.
You would not permit retrial.
I don't think he can. I don't think he can. He's got a directed verdict down there. The judge has said testimony's insufficient. He's been tried. He's been in jeopardy. I think you're through. And here's another problem you're going to run into on this double jeopardy. That I can see coming. It hasn't arrived yet, but I haven't any crystal ball. But I think where you take a man into the city court and try him for driving under the influence of intoxicating liquor, and the city ordinance says $100 fine or $50 fine, he's all through. I don't think the state can go on and try him again.
Didn't you say that?
Well, it hasn't been said definitely, but it's pretty strong in that. Yeah.
Are you saying then that the state wouldn't be able to go ahead and suspend your driver's license?
No.
You could bring him to the district court then.
Where you could give him a jail sentence and a bigger fine and so on and so forth. I think you're all through. And if the city wants to make it a $10 fine, he goes in and pays a $10 fine, he's through. But that's a matter of working, matter of
Representative Redden.
Harlan.
This keeps bugging me, Justice Perry. Maybe it's going to underlie all the work we do. I can't get express what I'm getting. I know society has a right to protection. I believe in criminal law for that purpose. I believe in that it serves a deterrent purpose. I'm concerned as to whether it serves a reformation purpose. I'm also concerned as to whether a lot of times when we're penalizing, we aren't really penalizing society when they pick up the bill for a family for 10 years. I'm just wondering if, even though we've got thousands of years of history behind the criminal law, if this committee shouldn't also consider just what the state can do. We're trying to do too much. We found in juvenile law, for instance, that we've got to put more of the burden on the community. The community the man comes from. The same thing in mental health. And I think we're attempting to do too much with our criminal law. I wondered if you have any comments. You've mentioned a little bit on these economic crimes. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, that's getting
it's
out
hard
for
me to express what I'm thinking, but
I know what you're thinking.
We're trying to do too much.
But I think you're getting outside of your work here. When you go into the sociological area, getting into the knowledge, I just touched on it too when I said that I felt that the mandatory in the German sentence. I think we all would judge that if it was a sex crime, you just look in the book to see what the maximum was and just toss it at the fellow, regardless of any of the circumstances. And I used to pride myself on the fact that I thought I knew more about what this man should have in front of me. And I'd gotten a little report from the pre-sentencing report, took a look at it. Yeah, it was going to be this or something, but I finally come to the conclusion. But those matters are too fragmentary, and quite often you don't like the way the fellow looks at you when he's sitting down here in front of you, and it may change the whole atmosphere. I've lost the idea that I had any confidence in that.
The thing bothers me about the pre-sentence report is that it's 99% hearsay, with no chance for the defendant to
examine it. That's true. I still am not sure that I want to go to the California system. I still think that
the sentencing him to the youth authority or adult authority and
like any term sentence. It seems to me that it's better to select the group that can observe the behavior, that can have the facilities to make the background examination of the individual and check his problems and how to reform those problems is a better system.
Is that what they do in the youth authority and adult authority?
No, not exactly. They get just about a little bit better report than I think our pre-sentence reports are.
My brother Tom, the youth authority, spends all his time going to these hearings.
Well, maybe they're just swears that they work like hell.
Well, I think they do.
Aren't there some states, judge, that permit the defendant and his counsel to see the pre-sentence report and to provide them an opportunity to rebut certain of the hearsay?
Yeah, we see it here.
We do that here. We don't show it to the defendant.
The counsel can always see that and go through it and ask him, talk to him
about every charge that's on there.
It's only been a few years.
Not all the circuit judges do it yet.
No. Sorry. Don't they?
No, they don't all let your pre-sentence. It's up to them, they tell you. Mr. Clark.
Representing Harlan, I mentioned the area of social control other than criminal law, and I think this really gets back to something Mr. Justice said regarding some of these reported crimes about victims, and the President's Crime Commission report indicating that probably we were attempting to do too many things with criminal law, and some of these things maybe shouldn't be considered violations of law. No matter of social policy we're considering. And I'd like to ask, do you think we should wade right into these, right off the bat, the areas of abortion, sex crime, drunkenness, marijuana, and some of these kind of crimes about victims?
Well, I think that's your problem if you're going into the substantive law.
Well, that's a part of the problem. We have crimes against property, against personal,
oh, yes,
and everything else. That's just one area.
And you've got too many areas of crime that could be limited down. I don't know that you need to have embezzlement from a bank is worse than embezzlement from an insurance company. You know, but you just got there's a big field there that can all be worked down. I think the American Law Institute, well, they put out this model criminal code. It's only put out as an outline. I don't believe that they ever requested any state to adopt. You know of it?
No, they actually have not.
They have to find Russell.
Where you and I come from,
Well, we've got cases, you know, where they, in the indictment, they called it a cow and it turned out to be a calf and so on. They, in that area, you tried to list every single animal that you could possibly steal. Certainly, why, if you steal, if the cow is worth more than $75, it's grand larceny. If it was only a calf that was worth $25, I don't know whether there is any money, it would be petty larceny. You see what I'm trying to say?
What you're saying is then that the theft of a cow ought not to be any different than the theft of groceries from the store or liquor from the golf club or whatever.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to get at.
And if you've got a dollar amount on the thing to differentiate between petty larceny, it ought to be the same dollar amount whether it's hay or cows or food.
It seems to me that way. Now, I may be entirely mistaken, but that's my impression.
Mr. Spaulding, you had some questions, I believe.
No, I
didn't. You? Is anyone else?
Well, I don't want to sidetrack if you want to go just with the substantive mandate, but it seems to me that your crying need is, with the procedural, it seems to me that your crying need is, lies over.
I think, you know, overall that's perhaps the next person that we have is the district attorney, who I'm sure has been listening very attentively. It's Courtney John, Linn County District Attorney. And I've asked him to appear before the committee and give us some of his views with respect, I suppose, to the general area that we've been discussing. Courtney?
Yes, well, thank you, Senator. One thing I am going to say, I mean, this commission looks like it's real well rounded and got a lot of hopes at some point. I remember on the bar committee for the criminal law and procedure this year and the year before, we recommended that there be a complete revision of the substantive and procedural laws of criminal law. And I think every time now, how should this be changed or that be changed, or should you have this or should you have that? And there'd always be a disagreement as to just exactly what we needed. But everybody agreed that we needed a change. Then the this last legislature had a question before it, whether to put this work before the law improvement committee or whether to have a separate commission. They decided on a separate one. And I think the reason they did that is because of the time factor. Under the law improvement set up, why they contemplated it would be a good many years before anything was accomplished. And I think the reason they formed a new commission, and the reason that district attorneys, for one, recommended it. And our bar committee was kind of split on that, on the question that this time business is real important. And I think that you can do a lot of good. Some of you are in the legislature, and you know that you get piecemeal this proposal or that proposal will get kicked around and debated around and shuffled around and lost. So you can't really have any criminal law revision on a piecemeal basis. You have to present them a pack. So now you're going to have, I think, two ways to go. Maybe you ought to go both ways. There are areas for reform. New social changes and maybe new ideas, and these are going to be controversial. You brought up a few of them here today, and they're controversial. Present this particular change to the legislature, and you know you're going to get a split on it. And then there's a big area where there shouldn't be any controversy, like house cleaning. Eliminating all these inconsistencies, plugging up obvious loopholes and overlaps and so on. Now here you're not going to have controversy. I think if you can present this package, they'll accept it and be glad you did the work on it, and we'll have a great many needed changes. I think also then you should present the more or less social reform. They'll buy that too. They ought to at least get to consider it. And even with the, maybe they can resolve these controversies. I know you mentioned something about having district attorneys and law enforcement officers and as an advisory committee or subcommittee. I think you ought to have defense attorneys in the same category. And then you ought to have these laymen. I think they're the ones that are going to resolve a lot of these questions. Maybe Bruce and I, for instance, would bring up some proposal and our views would be more or less opposite. Now, what should it be for the benefit of the public? I think you ought to just have the public not connected with it, what they want and what you're trying to accomplish. Get to these non-controversial matters, and just to illustrate a few little things where I think there ought to be something done right away, and have it already, and maybe get it passed by the next legislature. I think the bulk of the cases run check cases. I think the warden out there will tell you that mostly the customers are check cases. And then you've got larceny cases and burglary cases, and just probably about in that order. You've got obtaining money by false pretenses, where a $5 check can get you into the penitentiary under the check law. It takes a $75 check to get you in there. Often right. $20 or $30, $50 checks, and then you just committed 20 or 30 misdemeanors.
but he reaps hundreds of dollars. And you've got the old hands that are check writing, and somebody that just kind of wanders into a bad situation there, his wife gets him upset and he spends more than he has. I think this check law, in fact, I think if I had my way about it, there wouldn't even be a law against merchants. I'd let them take a little less responsibility. And the reason I say that is if they add up how much it costs to prosecute and how much it costs to support the man at the penitentiary and his family, and look how many repeaters you get. I think it was a present attitude of merchants that will never take anybody's check, is you know that you don't pay why you do it today. Current down to put them there.
Of course, under criminal law, there's no recovery for the merchant on a bad check.
Well, yes, there is.
Yeah, in fact, on that.
Restitution. Well, yes, in that respect. But a convicted man is part of his sentence is not, I suppose it is in some cases.
Always when he's placed on probation.
Yeah, the probation, surely there's going to be that.
Do this, then you're going to make this a civil matter and have the merchant have his attorney go in to collect.
I can't conceive of a merchant, for instance, if he knows that this deal is right between him and the customer, but taking somebody's check, if he isn't pretty sure that that's going to be a good check. Whereas now, they really don't even care. They just, you don't pay, you come to the city attorney.
You're referring now to NSF and no account checks.
Yes, I think
not forgery, sir.
No, I think there's an area where you have professional crooks in the check field, and that's a big business for them. Whether you should, I suggested at one time that an merchant would be limited in the checks that he could bring, that he could ask for prosecution. One of them would be, for instance, an out-of-state check. Here you got an out-of-state bank, the only way you can prosecute is to bring a witness from some other state. Well, that's a pretty big expense to the state of Oregon, and maybe it's a $20 check. Another thing would be, in other words, if this is a local, check on a local bank, well, that's one thing. Now, another, if it's for $2 worth of groceries and a $50 check, you're putting the merchants into the banking business. Another thing are the third-party checks, and so on. The merchants shouldn't be taking them, and they should maybe see the check written out in front of them. Somebody comes in with a check all laid out, right? He should be at least alerted that maybe there's going to be a slip up. But in any event, by the check laws need to revise.
Pardon me?
Yes.
Have you ever studied that Kansas Check Abatement Act?
No.
Well, I'm a little bit responsible for it. As we know, every district attorney wants to be reelected, and therefore they use him for a collection agency on bad checks. The Kansas Abatement provides that if they have had an account in the bank, I think within 30 days, they have the privilege of abating the crime. Not actually considered crime land, if they do abate it by paying the check. It acts as a collection agency, I would agree. I think there's a $10 or $15 additional charge that is made, plus all the costs of the case. They think that it has, it relieves a lot of work. They'll come right in, the district attorney
times as much as the check. It takes care of these smaller checks that are passed in taverns and places like that. As you know, it happens very often. And there is no expense to the state.
There's a check business now with the coming of the universal credit card, data speed, and the computer is becoming less and less a problem. Our employees never see a paycheck anymore. It's written by the computer and taken out of our computer's plan on their bank account.
Never, no wonder they're getting affluent.
They never have a piece of paper. Oh, it saves a lot of money.
Yeah, you could reverse the burden on these checks.
But do you see any real problem for the district attorneys in a...
On check business?
Would it help you? Because there you can discriminate between the professional criminal and the party who is... drinks too much and they write a $10 check down in the tavern. But they've had an account.
Well, I run a little check abatement proceeding myself.
Well, I know. does make a collection agency out of it. This makes a collection agency out of the state. But all costs are paid.
Well, that's something to look into, right? As long as the law is there, the merchant says, well, this is the law, isn't it? And I'll do something. And you look at the check, and no kid would have taken it. You can tell just at a glance that it didn't any good and never would have been.
Mr. Chairman, the House Judiciary once suggested to witness an Association of Oregon Industries who had backing a bill to increase penalties on check charges that reverse the situation by having a statewide license to cash checks, and any merchant who cashes three checks in 1 year that aren't good loses his license.
They have every tavern in the state of Oregon out of it.
They didn't approve.
Well, Courtney.
Well,
go right ahead.
I'm going to add one thing that under the obtaining money by false pretense statute, this would have, as I understand the law now, would apply only where there has never been an account. Under the NSF statute, you're going to have to go that way if they have ever had an account. Now, maybe this isn't true, but this is certainly true in Lynch County.
I didn't understand that. Could you repeat that?
If the person passing a check has never had an account, then you can prosecute under the obtaining money by false pretense. But if they have ever had an account, then you're restricted to the NSF statute.
Is that about the branch, too? Or
is that a state statute?
No, but I think that's, we've got an opinion along these lines, and then if you, when you get the banker down there, maybe the account is closed, but you ask the banker how he closes an account, well, they send a letter, and have no way of knowing whether that letter ever reaches their client.
What if you had an account 6 years ago?
And all you have to do to open that account is go in and make a deposit. You don't have to sign a new name, and you don't have to do anything else. They say it's closed, but the records are there. Make a deposit, and it's back again.
Well, a quick question. Very easy when you deposit $5 and every account is good for the rest of your life.
And that's just exactly what they do. Maybe they'll deposit $20 and go around the drive and line over this. And then get a little bunch of checks, and they get a check card number. Bank number, they drive around to the
bank America card with it now, didn't
you? Drive around to the outside drive-in window and withdraw $20 and go to the next bank and then start your tour.
I would just be reporting what if they've ever had an account there, then from then on out you're limited to NSF. I think this is maybe the interpretation. Supreme Court decision drawing the distinction between the NSF and the 1FP. come in on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, the bank gets hit with, say, almost, we have one instance where we got almost $1,000 worth of checks on that $50 that was deposited, but we were limited to prosecution as a misdemeanor on NSF. Now, this person really has the intent to commit a crime. He's opening that account. He's going out never intending to pay him. And there's a great degree of difference between this person, the guy who happens to overdraw his account a little bit, and because of an error in bookkeeping, that works. In our county, we have a hard time we don't get convictions on NSS unless we can show a series of checks enough so there's no question about his intent when the checks are cashed. But it'd be my view that if we're going to keep the check writing as a crime, a certain type of check writing, I feel it's definitely a crime, that you should be able to get have some a felony NSF rather than on the amount of the single check, a totaling of the value of checks that are cashed to make it a felony or misdemeanor. I don't think that necessarily an OMFP that's $5 should be a felony, although now the courts can treat it as a misdemeanor, so it can be treated as a felony or misdemeanor, but you got to go through all the felony procedure before the court treats it as a misdemeanor. But seeing the on checks, it should get a total amount of checks that are cashed, then you can distinguish between the person who's just overdrawing his account, although thinking that, or at least saying that he thinks he's got some money coming in, and the real pro that goes around and is making his living.
Well, Frank, and also Courtney, as district attorneys at the present time, would you say that in proportion to other felonies, including those which can be made misdemeanors, the check cases of one form or another are have the highest rank, the biggest percentage of your business?
I would. Well, I think Courtney, you're right, just right across the river from each other. We handle our checks entirely different. We don't allow any check to be turned over to us unless the person is turning it over simply for prosecution, not for the money back. If they want their money, we point them down to small claims or to their attorney. If this is all they want. And also, they can turn all the checks that they want to over to us. But until we've got, say, 8 to 10 checks in a short period of time, we're not going to file a complaint on it.
No, that means, I don't necessarily mean that you do file a complaint or take action, but the reported incidents of an offense, whether it's NFS or paying money, or regardless whether you take action on them or not,
well,
they constitute
a single crime. Although I don't necessarily hear about so many of the checks because our police agencies know that unless they've got enough for a prosecution, they don't even come to me.
We had a witness
that recorded what the checks were.
Well, it isn't true, too, that a large percentage of your check writers are alcoholics. Nearly means alcoholics.
You actually said good percentage.
Yeah, I would say this is the easiest way of, if you're going to call check writing a crime, this is the easiest way they can get money. They don't have to go down to the break into some store and get the cash box or something. All they got to do is write a check and get their money.
And what we're really talking about here is probably how many offenses create a crime, how many acts create an offense, and then the further problem of joinder and trial. Well, this goes past the check business. This goes to the guy who drives into town and drives too fast and bumps somebody else's car, stops in front of the bank, rushes in, knocks
up the bank, shoot somebody on the way out, and then drive too fast on the way out. And then the problem, further problem required, particularly as far as the defense is concerned, where do you, how much are we going to require the state to join these things and to get away from this whole business of keep trying all the way down the line until we hook you for something? Like the check thing.
Yeah,
if we're doing the same thing in the check business, if we're making commit eight different acts before we charge him with a crime on one act, we've got the same situation.
Well, I was really pointing out the inconsistencies. And, Frank and I are in the 21st Judicial District, and a senior judge, for instance, we had a case that where the man pleaded guilty to NSF, writing NSF checks and served a jail sentence, and then got out of jail, and the day he got out of jail, he went downtown and wrote a $74 check on the same account to the NSF. He claimed, and I charged him with obtaining money by false pretenses, and our court said no. So that's why I say that you're stuck with the NSF if they have ever had an account. And that isn't right. And then when you put the $75 limit on it, you didn't stop the series check, right? So you've got some gaps there to close. Larceny, you got embezzlement and larceny by Bailey. That one there is, for instance, it's a violation of the law now to buy something under a conditional sales contract and then take the property out of the county or purchase without written permission. How are you going to explain automobiles, for instance? A merchant comes in and says, well, this fellow bought some furniture and I can't find it, it's out of county. If that's the law, why don't you do something? And it's the law, right? But it's pretty ridiculous, and this is another collector's item. Nevertheless, it's large. Entering an auto with intent to steal is an indictable misdemeanor. Did that and stole two lipsticks. Then you got petty larceny and grand larceny. I don't know how long they've had the $75 value in there, but what $75 tomorrow compared to what it was when that law was enacted? Are you going to just put a price on it? And larceny in a building, that's real bad.
Shoplifting.
Shoplifting, there's probably no way to have larceny or have shoplifting without it in some kind of a belly. So you're inconsistent there. As a matter of fact, the burglary statute is another good item. You have larceny in a dwelling, and then another building, so you burglary even in a telephone. Shoplifting is burglary if when you walk through the door you intend to steal something out of that store, then this would be burglary. Whether it should be or not. And trespass. Trespass to enter upon the enclosed lands of that. Or what if we're not enclosed? Nothing. And yet it's illegal to go hunting on anybody's property without permission.
Warren Gill may dispute that a little bit, but you've got to talk to him.
Now you got negligent homicide. This apparently, at least, is intended to be the exclusive charge where there's death by a motor vehicle, and it takes gross negligence. But it would be manslaughter to drive a boat and turn it over and kill somebody. And then it only takes simple negligence. I think there's negligent homicide and manslaughter. If you want to go into homicides in general, it might
vagrancy law is kind of ridiculous. You use it a lot, and the police do, and don't ask them to. And I wish they wouldn't, but I doubt if there's any possible way to get enough evidence in to sustain a conviction under the vagrancy law, unless it would be the public intoxication.
Great question, though, there is to what the constitutionality of your vagrancy law.
It's already been thrown out in the city.
We have to call it something else and make it a specific crime, I think.
That's right. And now this public intoxication could be defined as trying to be drunk in certain places and not in other places. For instance, in a car. We had a situation there where this was just kicked around just to show you where we run into trouble on it. Against the law to be drunk on a public highway. So the driver and the passenger in the car on the highway said, well, they're not on the highway, they're in the car. And so the officer drives up and he says, will you please step out, man?
Did he warn them first of their constitutional rights?
First, there are a lot of blanks there when it comes to fraud cases. Salesmen and so on under the obtaining by false pretenses. They have a limiting evidentiary rule that you have to you can't charge obtaining by false pretenses unless the pretense is in there's some token or it's in writing. Knock out just a plain out and out false pretense. I think I'd take a look at that, whether that's a good law or bad. I think probably one of the biggest things so far as law enforcement is concerned is the law that you cannot convict upon the uncorroborated testimony of an accomplice. That sounds good. But to show you how frustrating that is, we had a fellow that admitted to 60 burglaries, named the time and the place and what was taken and who he was with. The property's all gone. Nobody's ever seen these two fellows together at any time, and there was no possible way to get any corroboration. Yes, there. That fellow that we knew had committed 60 burglaries. Well, maybe this is a good rule there, but now what if you get about three or four accomplices and they all come in? What are we trying to accomplish here? We don't want somebody to get convicted just on another fellow say so. But it can get to the point where it's a little ridiculous. Venue is something. I think you've got maybe a constitutional problem there. But presently, venue seems to be considered jurisdictional in criminal cases, not in civil cases. I don't know why, but it's necessary to. Why it would be jurisdictional. We found a body in our county and only indications were that it got to be a body in some other county. And then this was, if this had been jurisdictional, and if the
trespassing on our individual rights.
I'm going to say that you and I can't bet on this football game.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes, they would help. Yes, they're off the golf course too, I guess. Now, individually, if there was a law like that presented to the legislature, the legislators are fine. They vote one way or the other. They're in trouble. And I think maybe if you could put something into a revised law, that I would go through very much. I think the gambling laws are ridiculous to some parts of it or not. I agree that there's a certain amount of gambling from the time you're 2 years old. Now, when is it a crime? Might be a good idea to make it a crime only when everybody would consider it a crime. Now the matter of appeals, Justice Perry mentioned that. I think most district attorneys would be happy if they could appeal from when their whole case depended upon a ruling of the court. For instance, on search and seizure, if your evidence is knocked out and you don't think it ought to be, you're just stuck with it. If your confession is knocked out and you don't think it ought to be, there ought to be some review of that. Maybe just to establish what the law is under that situation. I know Justice Sloan was on this bar committee. He, of course, pointed out that the Supreme Court didn't want to be sitting up there ruling on moot questions. There are states where they just have an appeal on any point, just as a defendant. Both sides are entitled to appeal. And they've handled the business of double jeopardy by deciding that, by saying that, in holding, that the defendant is entitled to one fair trial, and if the trial wasn't fair, why he still has to go through another one, as it is fair. So there is some support for the idea of an appeal for the state, just as it is for the defendant. I think we're trying to be happy if we got on some of these matters without telling about it. I don't think that you don't have to interfere with the verdict of a jury. There are a lot of points where there should be some remedy if you don't need to clutter up the Supreme Court on these appeals. I don't think there'd be too many of them, but ones they had would be very important. Sentencing is another field. Alibi, and so on. And then I think there's another place for a review. Of course, we've been kind of talking about circuit court. The bulk of our cases are in the district court. We'll have half a dozen a day there, and then that's where we initiate most of the cases. Right now we have citations, for instance, instead of arrests. A lot of times the officer says, well, you show up at such and such a time, and I won't haul you in. You don't have to put up bail, but you'd be there. And he didn't have any authority to do that. And a complaint, when it's signed before a magistrate, it takes verification and so on. Where's the authority for the district attorney signing an information? There isn't any. And there's a lot of practices along those lines in the various counties that are not authorized. And yet they're the general practice, and everybody thinks it's fine and goes right along with it, but there isn't any law to should study what the basic practices are, and just starting out initially from signing a complaint to getting them into court and for bail and the initial appearances and so on like that, that there ought to be a uniform practice, and then there ought to be a law authorized.
Ned?
You've been a district attorney for, I don't know, 15 years now, I guess.
Longer than that, by 25.
What should be the goals that any district attorney has in the administration of justice, and what view should this committee take on this thing as far as devising a good overall system for the administration of justice?
Well, of course, that's a big question. I think you've already started to do it. I take a look at that American Law Institute, Modern Female Code, and I know that California is working on a new one, and New York's had a lot of changes, and I think Illinois and Wisconsin have just recently adopted a whole new revised criminal law. Maybe you could find the answers already been done by those states.
And I might say
crime is really advancing a lot faster than the administration of justice currently. And what do you answer to that?
What do you mean by that question? So crime is advancing faster?
Well, apparently the crime rates indicate that the present law is not successful in dealing with it. Or it indicates something to it.
Society going to do to reduce the amount of crime.
Mm-hmm.
Now that may be beyond the province of this committee, while it is an important field and ancillary to our other functions, which we should consider, of course, the sociological aspects that have a bearing upon this. But I think that the main function of the commission is not necessarily, except in a subsidiary role, to consider crime prevention. We will do so, for example, if we change the check laws and provide that certain acts which today constitute crimes no longer will, and the net result will be to reduce crimes in that respect.
Mm-hmm. Well, if the reduction of crime isn't one of the purposes of the law, then what is the purpose of this criminal law?
Well,
the
purpose
of it.
That's right.
Reform. Rehabilitation. It's all reformation.
Pardon me? You're the chairman, are you not, of the Law and Enforcement Committee?
I'm in the, on the bar.
Yeah.
Well, I'm chairman presently of the Committee on Criminal Law and Procedure.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm an outgoing member, and I doubt I'll be on it next year. I've been on it 3 years.
Well, there is at least continuity in that committee. What I was thinking about during the course of this past legislative session, there was some quite thorough debate as to whether or not this function that we're undertaking by this commission should be performed by the Law Improvement Committee or by a commission as you outlined. Now, it seems to me that due to our limited time and the background of your committees, that we should perhaps get some assistance from them. Would it be out of line, for example, for this commission, if the members desire it, to request of your committee that it submit drafts with respect to check cases, larceny, and burglary, as to what you feel should be done? Do you think that that could be accomplished in that way?
Yes, I do. And I might even point out that the one recommendation that our committee made to the state bar, and I'm sure they'll enact it, is that committee works with this committee any way that
how do the members of the committee feel about that? Seems to me that it's an excellent starting point.
Well, there's going to be a lot of drafting that should be done.
You bet.
And any help we can get from knowledgeable people, I assure you.
Well, that would give them something to do, and I know they'd be fit with that. This last year, they couldn't really get their teeth into anything. There were a lot of proposals before the legislature, and some of them were good and some were bad, but they were there, and it was too late to get in any new ones. And then they had their eye on this commission and be informed, either this one or something under the law improvement process. And I know they're ready and willing to help if we can do it.
You have described pretty much what the concept I had in mind with respect to procedure, what you have mentioned, plus what we discussed earlier. Namely, many of the practices that exist today for which there isn't any legal statutory authorization in the criminal field and procedure, plus the discovery and these other things we've been talking about. It seems to me that we could proceed with both of these fields at the same time and be certain that we will have something to submit. I'm wondering, would the committee have any objection if I were to address a letter to the Law Improvement Committee and request that they commence drafting statutes in these various fields that I have mentioned to be submitted to us?
Are you talking now about the Law Improvement Committee or the Bar Committee on Criminal Law?
Well, it's part of the Criminal Law and Procedure, isn't it the name of your committee?
Yeah.
No objection.
I think it'd be a good idea. Yeah, there's no objection. I'll do that.
I think otherwise they're going to be sort of stalled.
Yeah.
What to do themselves.
And I think one other suggestion, too, and I'm sure Frank will agree, the District Attorneys Association is interested in this, of course, and if you want any help out of that organization, they might even solicit all of the district attorneys to point out these things come up from time to time in an individual case, and then some discrepancy becomes apparent that maybe has been obscured. I'm sure they'd give you that's it.
May I make a suggestion also, Senator?
Yes.
Sure
that we can. Is that correct?
certain limitations.
Mr. Platt's going to talk to us this afternoon, and we'll have a better idea as to what they'll be able to do to help us.
I know that the judges have an association too.
Any further questions of Mr. John? If not, then we'll recess until 1:30, if that's agreeable. We continue. You know,